And good morning. Thanks for tuning in to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Connor Thomas, filling in for Leslie on this Thursday, April 17th, a spring rainy day. And with more on the weather in the Wasatch back, we've got Cedric Haynes from ABC's Meteorology Center. Good morning.
Good morning, Connor. Hey, I like that. A spring showery kind of day out there for us. But don't worry if you're saying, I'm just not ready for spring yet. Don't worry. It'll switch more to a winter-like day as we go into this afternoon. So as we kick off this morning, we've got widespread rain moving in ahead of a cold front that's making its way into the northern half of the state. But that cold front is going to be quickly dropping those snow levels as we go throughout the morning into the afternoon hours. So expect that rain to mix with and change over to snow both in Park City and also eventually into the Heber Valley as we go into this afternoon. So those temperatures are probably at their warmest point this morning when we got those temperatures that are in the 40s there in Park City and right around 50 in the Heber Valley. They will likely drop into the 30s as we go throughout late this morning into the afternoon hours, again, as we see that wintry mix of that rain changing over to snow later on today. Now, as we go into tonight, we may get a little bit of a lull in the precipitation this evening, and then we'll see another round of snow showers developing as we go into late tonight, heading into your Friday morning. And that means that, yeah, we could have some accumulating snow potential as temperatures will be dropping down into the mid-20s in the Heber Valley and will be dropping down into the mid to upper 20s in Park City. High temperatures as we go throughout your Friday, only in the 30s for Park City, with highs only in the 40s there in the Heber Valley. So, yeah, we could pick up anywhere from about an inch or so of snow for the Heber Valley as we go throughout the next 24 hours. And in Park City, we could be talking about several inches of snow, potentially anywhere from 3 up to 6 inches of snow potentially as we get into the Park City area over the next 2 days. So we're going to quickly go from spring to winter time over the next couple of days. So prepare yourselves for that along with those cooler temperatures. But then we get to some good news out there for you as we go into your Saturday. Lots of sunshine expected to return, and temperatures will start to warm up. We'll climb back into the 50s there for us in the Heber Valley for those high temperatures after a very cold start, though, with Saturday morning temperatures down around 20 degrees to kick off the day in both Park City and in the Heber Valley. But again, we should rebound into the low to mid-50s in the Heber Valley by Saturday afternoon, with highs in the mid-40s there in Park City. As we go into your Sunday, look for lots of sunshine for Easter Sunday. Temperatures starting off in the upper 20s across most of the area, but as we go into the afternoon, I'm expecting highs in Park City to climb into the low 50s, and I'm expecting highs in the Heber Valley to be into the low 60s. So a beautiful Easter Sunday forecast heading our way after some winter-like conditions over the next couple of days. Now, as we head into next week, we've got another weak system that'll move by. That'll bring us a chance of a couple of showers, rain showers, as we go into your Monday. Otherwise, temperatures will climb into the mid-50s in Park City, and highs will be into the low 60s in the Heber Valley. But yeah, Connor, get ready for that rain to switch over to snow as we go throughout this morning into the afternoon hours. So that spring-like rain you were talking about, not sticking around too long.
Uh-oh. Thank you so much, yeah. Cedric.
Thank you.
Coming up later in the broadcast, we'll be speaking with Utah Fire Info and the Division of Natural Resources on the coming wildfire season. We'll round out the hour with the Uinta Wasatch Cache National Forest with some information about recreating in the Uintas this year. Then at 9 a.m., it'll be Cool Science Radio. Katie Mullally and Lynn Ware Peak will explore a new invention, the world's first digestible diapers, that is, digested by fungi, designed to break down in a landfill, thanks to new fungi-powered decomposition technology. Then theoretical physicist and science writer Catherine Zurich from the California Institute of Technology talks about the mysteries of dark matter in her recent article on the topic in Scientific American magazine this month. Once again, you're listening to the Local News Hour. Well, the town of Hideout has begun the search for an interim mayor for the remainder of the year. Hideout Mayor Phil Rubin resigned, citing poor health. He was mayor for over 7 years, first elected in 2017, re-elected in 2021. In a statement shared yesterday, Rubin says his resignation comes as a result of health issues and wished the town continued success. The town will now embark on a search for someone to fill the seat through the end of the year. Voters will elect a new mayor in November. Meanwhile, Councilmember Chris Bayer will serve as mayor pro tempore, mayor for the time being, until mid-May. Hideout residents interested in serving as interim mayor must submit their names to the town recorder by May 8th. The town council will publicly interview the candidates and vote on Rubin's replacement during a special meeting, May 12th. During Rubin's tenure, the young community east of the Jordanelle Reservoir has seen continued growth and extensive construction. It's made plans to build a permanent fire station to improve emergency response times in their community. Hideout also annexed 350 acres of Richardson Flat in Summit County after a years-long tussle between the two jurisdictions. Rubin advocated for the controversial annexation, filed during a brief change in state law in 2020, saying it was a rare chance for the town to, quote, gain a voice that cannot be ignored. Rubin was not available for comment yesterday. And after weeks of discussion and community feedback, Heber leaders unanimously voted against using ranked choice voting for the 2025 city election. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has this.
Heber City used ranked choice voting in 2021 and 2023, but this November it will return to traditional ballots. Council members said they voted to go back to conventional elections in large part because they heard so much feedback from locals opposing ranked ballots. Councilmember Scott Phillips said people on both sides of the debate cared about the future of Heber. At first, he was interrupted by boos from residents in the chamber who opposed ranked choice voting.
Ranked choice voting has worked well in the past. It's made elections more civil and helped people feel more connected to the process. But the conversation around it has gotten clouded by misinformation.
Please, let him stop.
Phillips made a motion to end ranked choice voting in the city.
I'm going to vote for traditional voting in the 2025 election. Not because I think it's better, but because I think the fighting needs to stop.
Councilmember Aaron Sheetwood quickly seconded. Before the vote, he also voiced appreciation for the more than 300 comments members of the public sent to city leaders. The emails were still flooding in during Tuesday's meeting.
One of the things I ran on when I ran for this office was hoping for more public engagement. Boy, did we get it. We got it in a great way.
He estimated about 77% of the emails were from locals opposed to ranked choice voting. Mayor Heidi Franco, who advocated on her blog and on social media against ranked choice voting, thanked the council for voting according to the public feedback.
It doesn't make it easier for candidates, doesn't make it easier for voters, okay? But it's worth it. Whatever money we need to spend, that $16,000 plus for a primary, it's worth it.
The council voted 5-0 to use traditional voting. Primary races will be held if more than two candidates decide to run for each of the two council seats and for Heber mayor. Franco and Phillips have already announced their mayoral bids. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
And once again, you're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. I'm Connor Thomas, and on the phone with me is Kaylee Guild. She's the spokesperson at Utah Fire Info. Kaylee, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, hey there. How's it going?
So we've got you on to talk a little bit about the coming fire season. The seasons are changing right now. But before we begin, could you kind of explain your role and Utah Fire Info as an organization for people who might not be familiar with your work?
Yeah, for sure. So I actually work for the Utah Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, and I am the Prevention and Communications Coordinator for the whole state. So Utah Fire Info is actually an interagency website, and it has pretty much everything on it pertaining to wildfire or prescribed burns, fire restrictions. It's a great resource, a great tool for you to also go and see what's, you know, just what's happening across the state. So check it out, utahfireinfo.gov.
Yeah, resources throughout the wildfire season and around the year. So what broadly is fire season? Which months of the year are we talking about when we say that?
You know, we've kind of gone away from just calling it a fire season. It's more of a fire year, like you said. Typically, though, we see it start to really pick up, you know, April-ish for southern Utah, depending on, you know, whether we get warm, drying trends happening. But it's usually the end of April into close to, you know, 1st of November timeline. However, we have, you know, experienced some changes as of, you know, the last several years. The season has now essentially became a year. It's all year long.
Definitely in the desert, I'd imagine, in southern Utah. In the Wasatch back around here, the snow helps us a little bit, but that stuff's melting now. So what can you tell us about, is there a relationship between the snow melt and how much snow we get and that kind of moisture? And what does that mean for the fire season, especially in those high elevation areas?
Yeah, so you're 100% correct. You know, snowpack helps delay fire season and it keeps vegetation moist longer. A deep snowpack typically means that there's going to be a later start and a slower fire spread. Low snowpack leads to, you know, early drying of grasses and brush, which is essentially fuel for wildfires, especially in those lower elevations. Now, you did mention, you know, the higher elevations. So typically, if we have a heavier snowpack, you know, the fire season lays dormant for a lot longer.
What about some of the water helping the fuels grow, though? Is that something that is a concern the same year, maybe a long-term concern?
Yeah, and, you know, this year we were a little bit for our snowpack. You know, March kind of rebounded things for us a little bit, but we still kind of remained, you know, a little bit below, I think, below average for the majority of the state. You know, fire season this year, we are looking at, you know, it could be a little bit earlier, like as far as southern up to through western Utah. You know, we are anticipating that there's a possibility of monsoonal moisture that could come into the state. We do not have a great model just yet for timing. It looks like possibility into July. And I don't have a great, you know, outlook as far as the areas that it's going to be covering. But as you said, you know, areas with lots of grass from last year's wet spring could see potentially fast burning fires once things really truly begin to dry out.
And could you, I actually don't know what monsoonal moisture necessarily means. Is that that late summer rainy environment? Okay.
Yep. That's exactly it.
And that can kind of temper your wildfire season and maybe help those who are fighting fires once they do start.
Yeah. It's kind of a double-edged sword though, too. If you look at it, monsoons brings rain, but with rain, it typically brings lightning. So that's also another, you know, it could be good and it could potentially also be bad.
Very true. So there's that human-caused aspect, there's the natural aspect. It sounds like you're not totally sure what we could see as far as nature-caused wildfires this season, but, you know, average snowpack, at least for northern Utah?
Yes. Yep.
You know, what can you tell people about last year's fire season? We had a particularly big one around our radio station, the Yellow Lake Fire. What was it, good or bad compared to the average or the median fire year?
Yeah, so I actually pulled some stats. And, you know, overall, 2024 was moderate in acres burned. You mentioned Yellow Lake. Yellow Lake was significant due to, you know, the proximity to many homes and infrastructure that's in place, you know, and then compared to more of the severe wildfire seasons like 2020, I also recall 2012 was another significant year. 24 was less extreme, but it was still a wake-up call for folks within the wildland-urban interface areas to, you know, kind of do their part and to work on mitigation efforts around their homes.
Yeah, what's that wildland-urban interface term mean? Because I think a lot of listeners in our listening area fall into that boundary.
Yeah, so it's the area which it runs essentially into uninhabitable lands. So like your forests, or it might be state, you know, SITLA lands, or more of your foresty areas, truly. And it's essentially the communities that are building within those areas that, you know, it's great that we want to live in, you know, beautiful areas with full of trees and natural features, but it can also become a problem if we don't do our part.
Yeah, and, you know, certainly a risk the closer you are, because I guess fires tend to spark, or they spark more often in the wildland.
It's not necessarily that they could spark more often. It's more of, if the fuel's there, it's the likelihood it's going to take off and it's going to burn. And if it burns, you know, and you have a home within the area that's not properly, defensible, that's when we start to see people lose homes and communities.
Yeah. So what are some general safety tips when people, you know, want to make their homes defensible, and just other tips around staying safe regarding wildland fires?
Yeah. So great point. Clearing defensible space. And what that means is you need at least there's a radius. And if you go check out firewise.org, go look up at those items there. They have different degrees of how much vegetation you should clear out from around your home. You should have at least 30 feet around your home, should be free of flammable materials. And the closer you look at on this FireWise site, it will show you the proper, from 5 feet out, it will show you what you need to do to mitigate. So one of those things is maintaining your property, and that means cleaning out your gutters, you know, mowing grasses, trimming tree limbs, and then, you know, this is an essential thing, is storing firewood away from buildings, particularly your home. And then, you know, another thing you can do if you're looking at possibly building or, you know, constructing something, maybe retrofitting a home, you can use fire-resistant materials. And then another one is, you know, people can always be prepared, have a ready bag, so that you know, if you do have to evacuate, you know the routes, and that you know are connected with your local emergency management system. I know that there's a lot of different reverse 911s and those sorts of things, so make sure that you're a part of those.
Yeah, and I think people who lived close to the LA fire will be familiar with the ready bag idea. We talked a little bit about that fire earlier, and burn scars post-fire do also pose some safety risks. Can you kind of summarize some of those?
Yeah, they totally can bring risks. Flash flooding is, you know, even from just a light rain, what happens is the soil actually, it kind of deflects. It doesn't absorb in after a fire comes through the area. And so what happens is mudslides and debris flows, and, you know, erosion can take place and damage property and roads. And so it's super important to, you know, be aware of that as well. I would suggest, you know, signing up for weather and flood alerts. If you think that there's going to be a problem, you know, with your home or with your property, you could get some sandbags or barriers if you're in that risk area. And then, you know, be mindful if you are planning to go out, bike, hike, you know, you're driving through an area with a drainage near a burn scar. Be very mindful and pay attention to the weather, because it can change in a drop of a dime, and then you could be caught in something, you know, catastrophic.
Yeah, and again, we've been speaking with Kaylee Guild from the Utah Division of Natural Resources. We mentioned, you know, there's Utah Fire Info. Where else can people learn more throughout fire season and fire year, kind of stay safe and stay informed?
Yeah, I would say you can follow us as well on our social media channels. You can look up at Utah Wildfire. That's where a lot of the information is going to be, besides the website. So check that out. There's a lot of cool things, too. Like I said, it's an interagency effort, and so it's not just the state that's going to be talking about, you know, different things that are happening on our end. It's going to be federal partners as well. So, you know, you can stay in the know of whatever the Forest Service is doing or the BLM. Another great resource is our statewide fire prevention campaign. It's called FireSense. So you could go check out utahfiresense.org. It has a lot of cool information, prevention tips out there as well, for different behaviors. And yeah, if there's, you know, anything that you can always look me up, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have regarding wildfire.
Definitely. And you've got the Wildfire Wednesday videos, too. Are you planning to bring those back?
Yes. Yep.
Those are good for us reporting statistics on fire season.
Yep. Those will be coming back. I typically start them about the end of May, 1st of June. It kind of depends on, you know, the fire activities and the things that we're seeing. But that's, yes, it will definitely be a piece of it out there as well.
All right. DNR's Kaylee Guild, thank you so much.
You betcha.
The owner of the Yarrow Doubletree Hotel is appealing the Park City Planning Commission's decision to reject a redevelopment concept due to the project's 45-foot height. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports a new state law could play a role.
The owner of the Yarrow filed an appeal April 2nd with Park City, seeking to overturn the Planning Commission's move to deny a redevelopment proposal. The owner of the property, Singerman Real Estate, wants to demolish the decades-old hotel to make way for a modern mixed-use development. Buildings would be up to 45 feet tall and include a condo hotel, affordable housing, commercial space, and offices. The proposal exceeds the 35-foot height limit established by city zoning for the property located at the intersection of Park Avenue and Kearns Boulevard. Only one commissioner voted in favor of the project in March. Five others were against. The city's appeals panel will now decide whether the Planning Commission acted properly when it rejected the project. Under city code, when an appeal is filed, the panel has 45 days to hear it and issue a ruling. But for months, the city has been seeking to fill the third seat on the appeals panel. Right now, it only has two members. On April 14th, an attorney for the Yarrow owner proposed pausing the appeal or extending the deadline because of the board vacancy. Later this month, the Planning Commission plans to discuss changing the structure of the land use appeal process, which could impact how the application moves forward until the board vacancy is filled. But the appeal could also be setting up a test of a new law set to take effect May 7th. Passed this year, Senate Bill 262 allows local legislative bodies like city councils to settle land use litigation with a private property owner. Park City Councilmember Jeremy Rubel asked during a meeting last week about how the council could get involved in the Yarrow redevelopment application.
So it wanted to know what the process looked like and any tools council could have to essentially get involved in the application.
Rubel said the process could make sense given that Park City is currently creating new code for the Bonanza Park neighborhood, which would govern the Yarrow property going forward.
It does seem the Planning Commission did their job in applying the current code, but it's also a fact that we are very close to modifying the current code to allow for some density and height bonuses in favor of community benefit. This is a pretty good poster case for that. So it would really be sort of accelerating that process and being able to leverage where they are from a timing perspective and not miss the opportunity just because it takes years and years to actually modify the code. So
before the council can formally approve an agreement, Park City Attorney Margaret Plain told the council that two things need to happen. First, the application must exhaust all administrative remedies, which means going through the city's appeal process. Then a lawsuit would have to be filed in district court. If that happens, the city council would have the ability to settle with the property owner through a consent agreement. Planning Commission review and a public hearing wouldn't be required. Another option would be to negotiate a development agreement, which the council could approve as a settlement after a Planning Commission recommendation and public hearing. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
The annual Park City Song Summit has announced this summer's lineup, and KPCW's Christine Weller reports tickets are now available. The festival is moving to the City Park this year.
The Park City Song Summit's unique mix of live performances, open-ended panel discussions, and wellness events is headed to City Park this summer. The 2025 event runs from August 14th to 16th. Park City Song Summit founder Ben Anderson said the festival lineup will feature individual performances and collaborations from artists in a range of genres, including bluegrass, American folk, blues, and more. Among the scheduled performers are Goose, Marcus King, Green Sky Bluegrass, and Dawes. A special performance by the Terrapin Family Band that includes guest artists Eric Krasno, Adam McDougall, Jennifer Hartswick, and Nikki Blum is also on the festival bill.
Then we have what we truly believe is our special sauce, and that is called the Song Summit Labs. And those are panel discussions, artist-to-artist discussions, thought leaders, and it covers a range of topics.
One of this year's labs is Soul Kitchen, with singer Marcus King and James Beard Award-winning chef Andrew Zimmern. The pair will discuss the connections between mental health challenges in the culinary world and the music world. Another lab features electronic house music DJ LP Giobi, who will talk about her program Femme House that aims to create opportunities for women and LGBTQ+ individuals to enter the music scene. As in years past, the festival will also host late-night Main Street shows. The first performance is August 14th.
We'll start with a very special night with limited ticket availability at Le Depot Brasserie, my friend Galen Zamora's restaurant, right at the base of Main Street, the old Zoom. And Chef Andrew Zimmern and Marcus King will do a specially curated menu around each course being one of his songs.
The festival will be held in Park City's City Park for the first time. Anderson said the venue change allows the festival to put a spotlight on local businesses.
we can bring in our own food and beverage. And so that way we can have our friends and our food trucks and things that we know locally here to be able to come and, quite frankly, to be able to show off their product and be able to sell their product and make their lives more sustainable.
The park will feature a main stage and a stage for the Song Summit Foundation. Given the limited parking at City Park, Anderson said the festival is encouraging guests to walk or ride bikes. A bike valet will be on site. Attendees can also park at the Richardson Flat Park and Ride, Park City High School, or Deer Valley and take the bus for free. Anderson also said those who live between 8th and 15th Streets and Sullivan Road and Empire Avenue can buy discounted tickets. Anderson says it's a way to thank locals who will have the festival in their backyard. Tickets are available now starting at $35. To see the full lineup list, visit kpcw.org. The Park City Song Summit and its Song Summit Foundation are financial supporters of KPCW. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
And Park City has filled two key leadership positions that will oversee a wide array of city operations. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more.
Park City Municipal announced Wednesday that Heather Sneddon and Jody Emery will be its new deputy city managers. In their roles, the pair will be charged with overseeing daily operations of the municipality, providing strategic public policy support to the city council and city manager, and collaborating closely with department leaders, local residents, and businesses. Sneddon has nearly 20 years of experience as an attorney and is the former president of Salt Lake City-based law firm Anderson & Karenberg, where she specialized in business litigation and intellectual property disputes. More recently, she worked in real estate at Summit Sotheby's. At City Hall, Sneddon will lead the areas of housing and economic development, property, planning and engineering, along with managing the city's public-private partnerships. Emery, a Park City native, recently served as Associate Dean for Administrative Operations at the University of Utah's University Connected Learning Division. She has more than a decade of experience in budgeting, marketing, and personnel management. In her role at the city, Emery will oversee human resources, information technology, and finance, along with trails and open space. Park City Manager Matt Dias said filling the two positions simultaneously was a strategic decision to align each leader's strengths with the city's evolving needs. Sneddon and Emery start April 21st. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Despite an early snowmelt, the Wasatch Back's hydrologic outlook is positive. KPCW's Christine Weller reports that's because the snowpack has been above normal in each of the last 3 years.
National Weather Service senior hydrologist Glenn Merrill says the Wasatch Back's hydraulic outlook is really positive right now. That's largely because the area had above normal snowpack for the third year in a row.
So it's been almost three decades since we've seen 3 years in a row of above normal snowpack. Now, that being said, we were just slightly above normal.
Merrill said this season's storm tracks favor the Wasatch Range and brought beneficial moisture. Many Wasatch Back watersheds, including Weber, Upper Provo, and East Canyon, saw snowpack totals near normal or 110% of normal before the most recent melt. When combined, he said, a third year of an above-normal snowpack and 2023's record-breaking winter have helped the Wasatch Back become drought-free.
Much of western Summit County, including the Park City area, is drought-free, one of the only areas in the state right now.
However, Utah's snow is melting earlier than normal. The Beehive State's peak snowpack conditions typically occur the first week of April, but this year's peak was on March 23rd, with a near-normal statewide average. Merrill said an early peak means a less efficient runoff season. It's best when mountains hold onto the snow until late in the season and then melt quickly. That helps as much water as possible make it to Utah reservoirs. Moist soils also help with efficient runoff as they won't hold on to as much water. But Merrill said the snow is already melting and the state went into the 2024-25 winter season with drier than normal soils.
October was record-breaking heat, the hottest October on record. What that did was dry out our soils at a period of time where we're looking to get those early fall rain events to moisten our soils.
In Wasatch County, the Yellow Lake Fire also contributed to dry soil conditions. However, Merrill still expects Wasatch Back reservoirs to fill up or get close to full this spring. The early melt also means a longer warm season and possibly a longer wildfire season. Merrill said wildfire danger will depend on how quickly the state heats up and dries out going into late May and June.
Right now, Predictive Services is looking at large wildfire potential. They are not keying in on the Park City area as being an area that should be seeing abnormal fire conditions compared to normal.
Southern Utah, on the other hand, is expected to be at greater risk for large wildfires, especially because the southern parts of the state have critically low snowpack. One positive of a slower melt is a decreased risk of flooding. According to the Utah Department of Public Safety, flooding is the number one disaster risk in Utah, but there is a less than 10% chance of flooding this spring. However, Merrill said locals should still be cautious around rivers and streams this spring.
The water's moving so swiftly, and just within 24 hours or so, that water was snow. So it's extremely cold. If you fall into that water, the risk of hypothermia, you know, that happens within minutes.
Peak flow conditions occur during May. Merrill said families should keep a close eye on kids and pets around waterways, especially the Weber and Provo rivers. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Labor organizers say they submitted more than 300,000 signatures yesterday in an effort to put a bill banning collective bargaining on the 2026 ballot. House Bill 267, passed by lawmakers and signed by Governor Spencer Cox earlier this year, bans government agencies from negotiating contracts with unions representing public employees. So that includes teachers, firefighters, police officers, and other government workers. After it was passed, leaders from the Utah Education Association, Utah Public Employees Association, Utah Professional Firefighters, and others banded together to attempt to repeal the law. The group had 30 days to collect 141,000 verified signatures across 15 of 29 Senate districts in Utah. Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson now has until June 21st to count and verify the referendum petition signatures. If the requirements met, voters will determine the fate of collective bargaining on next year's November ballot. And the Utah Department of Transportation is preparing for road work season as warmer weather approaches Utah. UDOT announced 152 new construction projects with a $1.68 billion price tag. That does not include another 145 continuing construction projects across the state. The list does include a Wasatch County $53 million project in Provo Canyon to widen US 189 to two lanes in each direction on a 3-mile stretch of road near Deer Creek Reservoir. It will also add a traffic light in Heber, where US 189 and State Route 113 meet, and enhance the Island Beach day use area. Construction begins this summer and is expected to last until the end of 2026. In Summit County, UDOT will embark on a fourfold project involving Interstate 80 at Kimball Junction, the westbound US 40 to westbound 80 flyover, eastbound and westbound 40 between 248 and I-80, and the SR 248 interchange. Starting June 24th, crews will improve drainage and ride quality in those areas, reduce congestion, and preserve road infrastructure. Governor Spencer Cox has instructed all state agency heads to plan for a possible recession. During an Economic Outlook news conference, the Utah Republican says the state understands the business cycle, the innovation cycle, and does prepare for downturns. Cox says he's asked departments to plan for 3 levels of cuts if the country does slide into a recession. The Salt Lake Tribune reports the stock market has been on a tumultuous ride after, quote, Liberation Day, April 2nd, when President Donald Trump announced the most sweeping tariff hikes since before the Great Depression. After global markets fell, Trump reversed course and issued a 90-day pause on many of the tariffs. While Cox did not point to a reason for recession preparations, he has expressed skepticism over tariffs. During the governor's March PBS Utah news conference, he called them a huge gamble. The National Bureau of Economic Research defines a recession as a significant decline in economic activity spread across the economy that lasts more than a few months. And Summit County residents can go behind the badge this summer at the Sheriff's Citizen Academy. Applications are open for roughly 30 spots. Summit County Sheriff's Office spokesperson Skylar Talbot says the Citizen Academy goal is to connect the department with residents in a way that strengthens community ties.
So the Citizens Academy is a really great way to get people into the office, let them see what we do, how we train, why we do some of the things we do, and give them an opportunity to engage with us outside of, you know, that context where maybe it's, you know, an actual investigation or something like that.
The program starts this June. It'll let residents learn about everything from investigation to SWAT, dispatch, and everything in between. It's modeled on how deputies actually train.
We're going to take all of that at the end of the year. We're going to put it into a scenario day. And you'll essentially get to play cop for the day. You know, we're going to put you in a police car, and obviously in a controlled environment, we're going to simulate calls coming in and you having to respond to those calls to kind of give you an idea of what it's like to be a deputy.
The program is free, but the sheriff's office asks residents to commit to attending every session. It will meet weekly on Tuesdays beginning June 3rd through August 5th from 6 to 9 p.m. usually. There's no meeting July 1st, and a special session is set for Saturday, August 2nd, tentatively from 8 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon. Applicants must be a citizen, business owner, or stakeholder in Summit County, 18 or older, and pass a limited background check. There are about 30 spots that will be filled on a rolling basis. Email citizenacademy@summitcountyutah.gov for more information on how to apply. And as Utah Governor Spencer Cox wrapped up a trip to discuss trade partnerships in Canada, an ambassador from across the Atlantic landed in Salt Lake City with the aim of preserving business relationships. European Union Ambassador Jovita Nelyipsina came to the Beehive State with a message. If President Donald Trump follows through with aggressive global tariffs, no one but consumers will pay for it. The Salt Lake Tribune reports the Trump administration pressed pause on a 20% tariff on all goods from the EU for 90 days, but a 10% minimum universal tariff and 25% tariff on cars, steels, and aluminum remain in place. The EU ambassador says she hopes Utah leaders can help increase pressure on Trump to negotiate a trade agreement. She says trade was the highest priority on her two-day agenda, which included visits with Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson and two of Utah's six members of Congress. The EU is Utah's second largest trade partner. According to the ambassador, trade between Utah and EU member countries approaches $10 billion annually. Beyond inflating prices and disrupting supply chains, she says increasing tariffs risks eliminating jobs. The ambassador added over the last decade, Utah jobs at EU companies has increased by 48%. And again, we're looking at recreation in the Uintas this morning. And on the phone with me is the Uinta Wasatch Cache National Forest Recreation Staff Officer, Renee Flanagan. Good morning.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. How are you today? Good.
Gotcha. So you're the Uinta Wasatch Cache Recreation Staff Officer. Can you tell listeners a little bit about what you do and, you know, kind of the areas of Utah that you cover?
Sure. So I'm the Recreation Staff Officer here on the Uinta Wasatch Cache National Forest. That forest does encompass about 2.2 million acres. We run from Nephi all the way to Idaho border, and then a little west of Tooele all the way to Wyoming. So for those Wasatch Back listeners, that would include the Strawberry area, Mirror Lake Highway, Weber Canyon. We have about 9.5 million visitors a year, so a very busy forest. And obviously some of our most popular recreation activities include hiking, biking, OHV riding, hunting and fishing. And obviously we're wrapping up our winter season with snowmobiling, backcountry skiing, and here on the front we host five world-class ski areas.
Yeah, and with the change of seasons, it does seem like people are chomping at the bit, at least on social media, to get up there for summer recreation, in the Uintas especially. What's open, though? Is Mirror Lake Highway officially open?
So, yeah, Mirror Lake Highway obviously is seasonally closed. It will open this spring. That highway is managed by UDOT, SR-150. I have heard that they're pushing snow along the highway, but the best way to find out, the fastest way to find out information about Mirror Lake Highway is to follow them on social media. They'll provide updates as soon as possible when that is open. And, you know, certainly you can call our office there in Camas, and they'll provide updates as soon as they have information. But certainly the fastest is UDOT social media sites.
All right. So, you know, what changes winter to summer at the National Forest, and what kind of activities are you looking at this year?
So I think maybe a few that are applicable for the Wasatch Back users is the Soapstone Basin area. We are replacing the Soapstone Bridge, so the access off of 150 is closed right now. So that bridge is currently under construction. They are armoring the riverbanks now, trying to complete that before the spring runoff. They'll finish backfilling those abutments, and then pretty soon we'll get that deck on. And as soon as it's warm enough, they'll get their running surface. So we are hoping to open the access to the Soapstone Basin area from 150 later this summer. Until then, they can access it through Highway 35. But again, that'll be subject to kind of weather and snow conditions. I think also in the Wasatch back area, probably people are interested in the Yellow Lake fire closure area. And that is still closed, and it'll stay closed until we can do an assessment on the hazard trees and make that area safe for the public to enter.
Yeah, what kind of risks are there post-burn? We spoke with Utah Fire Info earlier in the broadcast kind of about flash flooding, but what does it do to things like trails and kind of the stuff that you manage?
Yeah, I think for trails, the main thing is, hazard tree. So they'll do an assessment this spring once the snow is gone and kind of determine what we need to do in that area to make it safe for the public to access. There is a lot of dispersed camping. We don't do a lot of work in the dispersed camping areas, and so we'll have to figure out exactly how to make areas. It's really roads and trails and adjacent areas that we'll try to do some mitigation.
Yeah. What kind of changes? Obviously, we have seen, nationally some federal rollbacks and staffing cuts. Are there any changes this year to your jurisdiction, and how might that affect, recreation here locally?
Well, I will say that, this forest has a lot of ways to serve the public through contractors, partners, and volunteers, and Forest Service employees. Like, for instance, we have about almost 500 recreation sites on this forest, and our highest developed ones are managed under a company, under a concessionaire permit, the company called Utah Recreation. So we're not anticipating any changes with services provided by Utah Recreation. So if you are reserving a campground through a camping site through recreation.gov, we don't anticipate any changes there. For Forest Service managed sites, we do anticipate some changes, and that's mainly going to be in operational and maintenance activities. And the best really way to find updates on those, because we have so many, is to contact your local Forest Service office. So for Wasatch back users, that's going to be the Camas office or the Heber office. And if any issues there, certainly welcome to call us here in South Jordan at our headquarters office.
Yeah, and actually, I think it might help to take a step back and maybe explain the difference between USFS and the National Park Service for people. I've always gotten the vibe that y'all are a little more hands-off than your partners at NPS.
Maybe expand on that question a little bit. What you mean? What your implication is by hands off?
I mean, just less staffing needed for national forests, because you contract with a lot of subcontractors for some of the logging operations, things like that. You have the concessionaires that book recreation campsites, things like that.
Well, we have a very broad mission, and our goal is really to serve the public. And our highest use on this forest, over 6 million visitors do general forest access, right? So your hunters, fishing, dispersed camping, those users, that's our highest use on this forest. And that's just an opportunity for people to get out on the forest, enjoy their national forest, don't necessarily have a lot of interaction with us. And really what we encourage folks to do is recreate responsibly. So it's an opportunity for people to get out, kind of renew that physical, spiritual, mental, the reason they go to the National Forest, right? And really it's just an opportunity for people to get out there. And really what we ask is they recreate responsibility, have a plan. If you take trash, pack in, whatever you bring in, please pack out with you and dispose of it properly. Extinguish your campfires and stay on designated travel routes. So really there's an opportunity for people to get out there and recreate. And we don't necessarily need to be involved with that. We have a lot of opportunity to cross the National Forest without, our necessarily day-to-day interaction with those users.
Yeah, and you always say no before you go. Where can people find resources to make sure that they're educated and staying safe when they do head out into a lot of these backcountry areas that don't have much cell service?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, one location they can go is on our website. There's an interactive map, especially for new users. So if you want to go hiking or you want to go camping, you can use that interactive map and it'll give you some of our, you know, more popular sites that they can go to. You can also really, you know, go or call to one of our local offices because they're going to have the most current information on recreation sites, any schedules, any road and trail conditions, you know, any closures in the area that you want to visit. I mean, the main thing is plan your trip and have kind of an alternative backup plan. Our trails are very busy. Our trailheads are very busy. Often they're full. And so if they are full, make sure you have somewhere else you want to go, and that really will help you have an enjoyable and safe trip.
Definitely. We've been speaking with Renee Flanagan. She's the Recreation Staff Officer at the Uinta Wasatch Cache National Forest. Renee, is there anything else that you wanted to mention for listeners ahead of the summer?
I think mainly just recreate responsibly and really enjoy your summer. That's what the National Forest lands are for. And we really do hope you have a wonderful summer, and reach out to any of our local offices if you have any questions.
All right, Renee, thanks so much for calling in.
Okay, thank you.
The Olympics will return to U.S. soil in 2028 for the first time since the 2002 Games in Salt Lake. The Los Angeles Summer Olympics has announced the more than 40 Southern California competition venues that will host more than 800 events. L.A. 2028 will be the first game in 80 years to not build any new permanent venues and will instead use the city's roster of existing stadiums and arenas. Included in those venues are L.A.'s Dodger Stadium, the Rose Bowl Stadium in Pasadena, and Venice Beach. Also on the roster is the iconic Universal Studios lot, which will host Olympic squash, one of five new sports at the 2028 Games. Baseball, softball, flag football, and lacrosse will all debut on the world stage, and cricket, which has been absent from the Olympics since 1900 in Paris, has been added back into the lineup. While most sports will stay in California, softball and canoe slalom events will be at venues in Oklahoma City. Athletes will compete in the 2028 Olympic Games from July 14th until July 30th. And coming up Saturday is the first day of National Park Week. To celebrate, the National Park Service is letting visitors into any of its 400 parks for free. That includes Utah's Mighty Five, Arches, Bryce Canyon, Canyonlands, Capitol Reef, and Zion from April 19th through April 27th. Outdoor enthusiasts can celebrate the parks with a National Park playlist by listening to a curated collection or creating their own playlist inspired by a park's features and experiences. The Park Service will challenge visitors each day with a new genre, including greatest hits, pop nature sounds, classic rock, heavy metal, and more. Details on that are available at kpcw.org. And Park City's Ride On campaign saw more than 3,300 riders using public transit over the last 4 months. From December of last year until April of this year, the city says residents and visitors reduced single occupancy vehicle trips by shifting 26,000 trips to public transit, walking, biking, or carpooling. And we've got time for one more bit of Olympics news. The Olympic and Paralympic torches for the Milan Cortina Games have been designed to ignite anticipation and enthusiasm for the 2026 Winter Olympics. Games officials say the torches are a tribute to Italian design, celebrating the bond between man and nature. The Olympic torch features shades of the sky, while the Paralympic flame carries colors of the mountains. The Olympic torch relay debuted at the 1936 Summer Games. The tradition did not open Winter Olympic events until 1952 in Oslo, Norway. Since then, it has marked the start of every Olympic Games to date. For the 2026 Games, torchbearers will carry the flame from Rome to Milan. The relay begins December 6, 2025, and ends February 6, 2026, at the opening ceremony.